Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Professional Responsibility and Legal Education Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, September 25, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will discuss judicial disability, especially regarding whether the federal courts can inquire into mental fitness. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Professor Charles Gardner J., John F. Kimberling Professor of Law, Indiana University Maurer School of Law, Professor Arthur D. Hellman, Professor of Law, and Sally Ann Simenko, Endowed Chair at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, and Professor Ronald Rotunda, Doy and D. Henley Chair and Distinguished Professor of Jurisprudence, Chapman University, Dale E. Fowler School of Law. I will turn it over to Professor Hellman to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Arthur. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Laura. Well, last month, the Committee on Judicial Conduct and Disability of the Judicial Conference of the United States, that's the highest judicial body that administers the federal judicial misconduct system, issued a decision in which it affirmed an order of the Sixth Circuit Judicial Council directing Federal District Judge John Adams of the Northern District of Ohio to undergo a mental health examination and then to submit to any treatment or counseling deemed necessary. So that's a pretty remarkable thing. The conference committee acted under the authority of a law that Congress passed in 1980, and since then the examination ordered by the council and the conference has been, as you would expect, very rare indeed. What precipitated this? Well, it all started with one of the most routine cases you can imagine, a Social Security disability appeal in the district court. In the Northern District, as in probably most district courts, Social Security disability appeals are considered first by magistrate judges. Now, magistrate judges are appointed by the district courts for limited periods of time. They're not Article III judges, but they do a lot of the work of the district courts. Well, this particular case had been assigned to Judge Adams, and Judge Adams had established a scheduling order for all Social Security disability cases. Turned out that one particular magistrate judge had not complied with the order, and Judge Adams issued an order to show cause, saying that if the magistrate judge did not submit his report and recommendation by Monday at 4 p.m., the judge would find him in contempt. This show cause order was issued on Friday before that Monday deadline. Well, the magistrate judge scrambled, and he got the report in, and the Judge Adams did not find him in contempt. But this whole proceeding aroused the concern of the other district judges within the district, and they filed a complaint. Some of them filed a complaint of misconduct against Judge Adams based on the issuance of this show cause order. The acting chief judge of the circuit appointed a special committee to look into this, and later the acting chief judge expanded the jurisdiction of the committee to consider whether Judge Adams was suffering from a mental or emotional disability that was impeding the administration of justice in the district. The special committee wanted Judge Adams to undergo a mental or psychiatric examination. He refused, and ultimately the council held that his refusal was misconduct, as was the issuance of the show cause order. Both of those rulings were appealed to the National Committee, the Conduct Committee. The Conduct Committee found that the show cause order was indeed misconduct and that Judge Adams should be publicly reprimanded for it. It also found that the Judicial Council was reasonable in asking Judge Adams, requiring Judge Adams, to undergo the psychiatric or mental examination. Judge Adams has now filed a civil suit in the District Court for the District of Columbia challenging the council's order requiring the mental examination. So that's where the matter stands now. The Judge Adams has been publicly reprimanded for issuing the show cause order, and we're going to see litigation over the mental examination requirement. I think both of those aspects of the case are significant. The show cause order as the basis for a finding of misconduct is significant because there's a provision in the statute itself that says that a complaint alleging only conduct directly related to the merits of a decision or procedural ruling does not constitute or allege misconduct within the meaning of the act. Well, here, Judge Adams was reprimanded for issuing a show cause order, and you would think that that would fall within the exclusion for conduct directly related to the merits of a decision or procedural ruling. But the National Committee decided that it wasn't for two separate reasons. First, it said that the order was motivated by animus or hostility toward magistrate judges. Second, it pointed to the effects of the order within the district court, magistrate judges being very concerned that if they didn't do exactly what Judge Adams wanted, they'd be in trouble, they might be subjected to a contempt order, and that this was leading them to prioritize Judge Adams' cases over the other cases. I find both of those rationales troubling, and in a sense for the same reason, because if you look at, if you can get around the what I'll call the merits exclusion by referring to animus or motive, or by looking at the effect of a ruling, you've pretty much gutted the exclusion, because in almost all instances, you can find either an animus or an effect. So I'm concerned about that. I'm also concerned, of course, about the requirement that Judge Adams undergo a mental examination. Now, I do think that the council has that power over a federal district judge. It's probably in the statute. That's a reasonable reading of the statute, although there's nothing explicit about that. But it does seem to me that both for Fourth Amendment reasons, privacy reasons, and judicial independence reasons, before you order a federal judge to undergo a mental or psychiatric examination, you should have some pretty strong evidence of a mental or emotional disability that is interfering with the judge's ability to do his judicial work. And they just didn't have that here. He obviously, Judge Adams has some real problems with his colleagues, and that's causing some problems within the district court, but there's nothing in the record as far as the Judicial Council decision is concerned or the National Committee decision to show that any of this animus or hostility, whatever it is, has affected his judicial work. And without that, I'm not sure the order should have been issued. I think I'll just stop there and turn the program over to my colleague, Professor Rotunda.
Thank you, Art. This is what I would call, I think, the straw that broke the camel's back. For example, he's done a whole bunch of things. There was a young intern who accidentally parked into his parking space. He used his own car to block the car so that she couldn't get out. He was jogging in the trail behind the courthouse, and what Art said about magistrate judges, he bumped into one. And so he just kept spinning away and didn't stop to see if his fellow judge was hurt. The
He's been overturned by the Court of Appeals for just really a strange activity. For example, there's a criminal case in which a defendant said he did heroin with members of Adam's family, and the judge refused to disqualify himself. And the Court of Appeals forced him to disqualify himself. There was a case, and in the Social Security case, we have the magistrate judges kind of have an appellate relationship with the trial judges who can reverse them. And since they don't have lifetime tenure and salary protection, they're worried about getting rehired. It is what unusual, if not unique, that you would put the lower court judge, the magistrate judge, in contempt of court. I mean, that's just kind of a strange one. He had for many years a case involving firefighters, and the mayor of the town wrote a long letter asking him to disqualify himself. I think it was in the city of Akron. He refused to do that. They filed a form of motion and refused to disqualify, and then the Court of Appeals disqualified him. In that case, for example, he ordered it was a case involving alleged racism in the fire department. He ordered firefighters who had not passed the test to be promoted. White firefighters who had not passed the test should be promoted over white firefighters and black firefighters who did pass the test. It's like really strange. Apparently, if you pass the test and you're black, you're not as good as the white guys who didn't pass the test. But that's what he did. And he was on that case for 9 years. And one of the things the Court of Appeals said is that he's got to get this case moving. Talk about delay of the Social Security case. His case was on for 9 years. The Court of Appeals said he had, quote, substantial difficulty in putting out of his or her mind previously expressed views or findings about previous portions of the case. And they also said removing the case is an extraordinary measure, which we hesitate to invoke, end quote. But they did it anyway because they just found him very strange. Now, I don't think we should worry about somehow loss of judicial independence. We're allowed to criticize judges. Court of Appeals are allowed to criticize trial judges. If we couldn't criticize trial judges, law reviews would be out of business. But we do have a series of actions by a judge that indicate or suggest that he either is too big for his britches or maybe got a mental health problem. Now, he says that his psychiatrist says, or at least the people he contacted, say he's in great shape. And so you wonder, wouldn't the simplest thing to do to be just have an independent psychiatrist evaluate you if you're confident of coming up with the same conclusion? No, instead he files an original case in the district court for the District of Columbia. So eventually we're going to hear all about this. But it is what John Cribbett, my former dean at Illinois, called a prickly dingle, a guy who never heard the word before. You can kind of figure it out. A fellow who is very difficult to get along with. Maybe he has the view of some judges when they ascend the bench that they're gods in their courtroom. And he just seems to have this anger management problem. The Court of Appeals, the committee evaluating, said that they had a, quote, reasonable basis for concern as to Judge Adams' mental or emotional state, end quote. This has happened before. It happened with Judge Brian Barnett Duff in the Northern District of Illinois, who was persuaded to take a leave from the court at full pay for mental problems. This was what brought this to the hilt was a case where the Justice Department wanted him disqualified from all criminal cases brought by the United States because they found his rulings weird. He had been overturned various times. One case they presented a handwriting expert, and the judge said he would be the handwriting expert. There was another case involving the state of Illinois where he wanted to have an ex-party meeting with the governor about this particular issue. And lawyers said that he went berserk unless you call them Judge Brian Barnett Duff. The same thing for the Seventh Circuit. If you didn't use his full name, if you just referred him as Judge Duff, as the Seventh Circuit might, he went ballistic. And lawyers told me that if you did not refer the full name in any paper you filed with him, you would lose the motion. So we do have these judges who may not be criminally insane in the sense of the McNaughton sense. They cannot distinguish a melon from a human head, but lack major judicial disinterestedness and disinterested objectivity. They lack judicial partiality. And I think the judge ought to have the psychiatric test, and we'll see what happens next. Though what he's apparently going to do is it's all going to be litigated in the D.C. Circuit. So eventually we'll find out if the judges can do this to other judges. We are talking about judges with lifetime tenure and salary protection. So the only way you can force a judge to have the mental test is when you convince his colleagues that he's got a mental problem. And they shouldn't be subject to the whims and arrows of outrageous criticism from the press, because they also have lifetime tenure and salary protection. Charlie, what's your reaction?
Yeah, thanks, Ron. The reason I think this is a really interesting case is that it in some ways exposes a flaw that is arguably a part of the constitutional design. That in the Federalist Papers, Hamilton responded to criticism that there is nothing in the Constitution to deal with the what he described as the inability of judges, and he sort of shrugged and said something fairly non sequitur, like, well, that would just be disqualifying, without really addressing the problem of what do you do if you have a judge who is mentally ill or senile, but it's not an impeachable crime. And that became an issue in the very first impeachment proceeding of John Pickering, who was a strident Federalist, which is why he was irritating the newly elected Republicans. But he was also a drunk and, by all accounts, insane. What's kind of the irony here is that in 1801, the Federalist Congress, with Pickering in mind, created a statute to replace him and keep him on the payroll, but replace him with a judge who wasn't insane. And so he was removed. Then the Republicans came into power, overturned the Midnight Judges Act, and overturned the provision that kept Pickering off the bench and put him back on the bench, and they had the problem all over again. He was ultimately removed, and I mean, one of the ironic defenses his family offered was that you can't remove him because he is hopelessly insane, and it's not crime to be insane, so he has to stay on the bench for the rest of his days. The Senate didn't buy it. The problem really is that you have an understandable and legitimate concern here, which is dealing with senility and mental illness. You also have what I think worries Arthur. You have this risk of gaslighting. In other words, that you've got a life tenure judge who's being belligerent, and you know, if being belligerent isn't an impeachable offense, you know, can we call him mentally ill and have him removed via the 1980 Act, which in effect revisited the 1801 legislation with a new, more elaborate system for identifying and setting to one side the mentally disabled judge who is not technically removed because he is not taken off the payroll, but which does allow you to keep him from hearing cases and to bring in a new judge to take his place. To me, this isn't a normal judicial independence issue. That normally what you think about is decisional independence of the judges, their freedom to decide cases without external interference from the political branches of government or from the media or from the public on the one hand, or you think about the institutional independence of the judiciary to resist encroachments from the political branches. This one has to do with the independence of judges from each other. And, you know, there were some arguments about that when the 1980 Act was passed, and the argument was that the Act itself is unconstitutional because it's an encroachment on the independence of judges, essentially to do what they want to do, and that argument was not accepted. That in that sense, it's a weaker claim. The thing about this, though, that I think causes people like Arthur to be concerned is that in the normal course, when you have judges judging themselves, you have a vested institutional interest in not overreaching. In other words, that I'm less concerned about judges second-guessing their colleagues' conduct than I am about members of Congress who have ulterior motives. But in a case like this, where the core problem is that you have a judge who is refusing to play nicely with others, including his colleagues, and is being a pain in the neck to his colleagues, there suddenly becomes an interest in interfering with him to a greater extent than judges normally do. And so it does raise the understandable concern. Now, in this case, I think that, you know, my attitude is somewhere between Arthur's and Ron's. That I think that you are looking for, you would like to see some more evidence in the record that this judge is behaving erratically in ways that signal mental illness, even though I think, as Ron says, there it's out there. It wasn't the focus of the underlying proceedings. On the other hand, I do think, or I do share, the view that it makes sense to go ahead and, you know, until you get a psychiatrist, you know, filing a report, you know, having lay judges, I mean, not lay judges, but judges who aren't medical experts, opining on evidence of erratic mental illness until they hear from someone who can inform their judgment, that it's premature for them to be doing much of that. Last point I'll make is that you know, in many ways, the state systems have the leg up here because they have a whole lot more latitude when it comes to dealing with judges of this kind. In the Code of Conduct for U.S. Judges, the only applicable provision dealing with belligerence is Canon 3B1 of the Code of Conduct for U.S. Judges, which says a judge should diligently discharge administrative responsibilities, maintain professional competence in judicial administration, and facilitate the performance of the administrative responsibilities of other judges and court personnel. It's this latter clause. What does it mean to say the judge should facilitate the performance of the administrative responsibilities of other judges and court personnel when this court judge seems to be a perpetual fly in the ointment who is not cooperating at all? In the Model Code of Judicial Conduct, you've got much more explicit rules, which are, I think, you know, which might well be properly included in the federal code if they thought about it. Rule 2.5 says a judge shall cooperate with other judges and court officials in the administration of the court's business. And another provision says, in Rule 2.16, it says a judge shall cooperate and be candid and honest with judicial and lawyer disciplinary agencies. In other words, you don't get to do what Judge Adams is doing. In state systems, if he persists in this, they have the power to remove him. And the federal system, of course, doesn't. The most they can do is, you know, suspend him, which they tried to do in this case and which was reversed. And it still makes me a giggle a little bit, which says, you know, and for your indiscretions, you shall be put, you know, you shall be given a paid vacation. But that sort of is the worst they can do apart from recommend impeachment. And in this case, I think that got reversed until, which I think was understandable and right, that until it was decided that he had a mental illness after an inspection, it was premature to say that he was incapable of managing his caseload. And so, you know, we proceed from there. Only other comment I'll make is as regards to the concern that Arthur raised about, is this merits related? I did find myself persuaded by the Judicial Conference Committee's explanation that merits-related bars do not prevent the judiciary from regulating conduct that is prejudicial to the effective and expeditious administration of the business of the courts. That's just quoting the statute. But then it went on to say this includes actions that affect the judiciary's ability to manage and regulate itself, including conduct that impairs the ability of other judicial officers to perform their functions. In other words, this is really an unusual kind of judicial decision, one in which the judge is essentially bringing out a 3-ton gun to swat a fly, using this vehicle of a show cause order in an almost unprecedented way, which is aimed at self-regulation of the judiciary rather than the normal course of deciding a case. And so for that reason, I was comfortable with the conclusion that this was not merits related in the way it usually is. And with that, I'll subside and turn it over to the others.
Ron here, just to add some comments. I don't think this is a problem that the judges don't think that Judge Adams plays well with others or other judges. what he's doing is hurting the litigants. They removed him in the case involving the drug abuse, or actually the drug sales, where his relatives, the witness, the defendant, said it was involved. It's hard to expect a fair hearing from a judge who is having his relatives on trial as well through the testimony. In the firefighter's case, he was removed. The committees, because you know these judicial things tend to be very hush-hush and quiet, but we know more because Judge Adams has filed a case in the D.C. Circuit. And he says in his complaint that the committee wouldn't entertain the findings of his psychiatrist. They couldn't cross-examine. It was just conclusory. But they entertained, he said, the opinion of a psychiatrist who examined the public records. And that psychiatrist said that what he or she, I don't know whether it's a male or female, but he or she learned from those records, they suggest, quote, significant personality traits may have contributed to the current concerns about Judge Adams, end quote. So this isn't just sticking a finger in the air and figuring out which way the wind is blowing. They have a psychiatrist who is perfectly happy to interview and check out the judge personally, but based on the written record, he thinks there's significant personality problems. Some years ago, I wrote a column in the Washington Post about judges should have a little more watchdogs, federal judges. You know, and Charlie talks about them getting a paid vacation. Well, that's true. Because of the Constitution, we have to impeach them before we take away their salary. But the point of the paid vacation is they stop hurting other litigants. If they do something else like sweep around the courtroom, if we can make them do that, that would be good too, but we can't. Judge Kane, a federal judge, wrote me after when I was talking about this issue, and his email said that quote, I've been a district judge for 29 years. This was in 2006, so it's now 39 years, and thinks the federal judicial house has brought this legislation on itself. Said he was sitting on a council. A discipline about a judge came in consideration. A district judge was trying to coerce counsel into establishing a library on product liability cases in honor of the judge. And the committee didn't find anything disciplinable about that. As they left, one of the judges who voted to dismiss, he said he collared me and said, next time it could be you or me, we've got to stick together. The judges are not very good in cleaning their own house. It had to take something extraordinary to move a committee to say that he ought to be evaluated by a psychiatrist. And he does have an awful lot of strange rulings that are routinely reversed by a court that doesn't normally reverse. It's very hard to get a district judge disqualified if he or she refuses. But this guy was able to persuade the Court of Appeals he was in error for sticking on a case, including the firefighter's case, which he was on for years, and they threw him off.
Oh, this is Arthur. The cases Ron has mentioned are interesting and may shed some light, but they are no part of the record that either the Judicial Council or the National Conduct Committee relied on. I think it's instructive to compare what happened here with what happened in the proceedings a few years ago involving Judge Manuel Real of the Central District of California in Los Angeles. The accusation there was that Judge Real had a pattern and practice of disobeying directives both from Congress and from the Court of Appeals. And there were a whole bunch of rulings in which he had been reversed and taken off cases. But the conduct committee said that is not enough. You have to have more than that. You have to show willfulness in order to impose discipline, because that does pose too much of a threat to judicial independence. It is, unless it's an extraordinary case with repeated malpractice, malfunctions, to get out of the merits-related exclusion. So maybe that went too far in the other direction, But a single episode here, the show cause order, and I should emphasize that Judge Adams found that the magistrate judge had done what he was supposed to do. He did not, in fact, hold him in contempt. That was a couple of years ago. That has not been repeated. Whatever Judge Adams may have done in cases as a judge, that is not part of the record here. And it seems to me that in misconduct proceedings, as indeed in everything the judges do, following the procedures and making the record is a very important part of legitimacy. And it seems to me that the episodes involving Judge Adams' adjudicative record, actions, are not part of this record. So I don't think we can consider them in deciding whether the order was justified.
This is Charlie. Question for you, Arthur, because I alluded to it, and I'd be curious as to your reactions. I mean, I grant you that in Judge Reel's case, it was case after case in which he was sitting as in his normal capacity as a judge, and issuing orders applicable to the parties that were giving rise to these recurring concerns, which, as you say, didn't overcome the merits related problem. I mean, to me, this feels like a very different kind of case in which the problem isn't whether he was right or wrong about issuing the show cause order, but whether trotting that mechanism out at all for the purpose of supervising magistrates within his jurisdiction was itself the problem. In other words, that this isn't about the merits of his decision. It was about the way in which he is managing his magistrates and doing it in this very belligerent, very confrontational way, which has nothing to do with whether he was right to, you know, say, yes, this is, you know, we need to swat this fly, but I'm going to do it with a thermonuclear weapon rather than with a fly swatter.
You know, all the judge had to do was call up the marshal or the magistrate and say, look, can you get this to me by next Monday or Tuesday? It's not issue an order putting the fellow in contempt. But he seems to lack judicial temperament, but in a very peculiar way. It's always about pushing, exerting power. That is not what a good judge, the way a good judge does. The judge I clerked for said that if you ever put a lawyer in contempt, and this is a judge putting another judge in contempt or threatening it, so it means you've lost control of the courtroom. You shouldn't have to do that. You should have proper judicial temperament. And I think Art's true, Arthur's true, that we don't have as many discussions in this judge's orders we'd like. The problem is they tend to be very much in secret. In fact, when Judge Real, or Judge, he wants to be called Judge Real, or he'll get very upset, though his mother called him Real. But in any event, when that case went to the Judicial Conference on Appeal, they never mentioned the judge's name. They're so careful about protecting everybody that this referred to as judge. We know about this because the press has covered it, and Judge Adams has filed a complaint that releases a lot of it. But otherwise, it's all very secret, and we worry about foxes guarding the hen house, and that's what seems to be here.
I'd like to respond to Charlie's question. What we had here was a single instance, and in fact, Judge Adams admitted that he should not have issued the order to show cause. If you go back over the record of judicial misconduct proceedings, a single incident like that in which the judge admits he is wrong almost never gives rise to a finding of misconduct, let alone a public reprimand. I mean, I agree with Ron that in the past the judiciary has sometimes gone too far in the direction of lack of transparency, of not disclosing what's going on. That has really changed in the last 10 years or so, and I think it probably coincides roughly with the chairmanship of Judge Anthony Sirica at the head of this chair of the the conduct committee. It's a very, very different attitude since he took over there. But, you know, we've heard talk here about, using a cannon instead of a fly swatter. It seems to me the public reprimand here was a cannon instead of a fly swatter. It would have a private reprimand would have been quite sufficient. And if it happens again, I mean, that's the other point that I think is important to emphasize about the Judicial Misconduct Act. When Congress passed the law back in 1980, when it was discussing it in the late 1970s, the emphasis was on looking forward, not on punishing judges, because they're going to be there unless you impeach them. You're not trying to punish the judges, but to move forward. And it seems to me that some lesser reaction to this show cause order would have served that purpose better than the public reprimand that has now generated a mental examination and a lawsuit.
I'm not sure that the public reprimand is what generated the everything else. I mean, it seems to me that
the investigation
began. The fulcrum or the focal point is this show cause proceeding. But it led to, it's clearly led to a variety of other findings that expanded the inquiry. And so I think it's a little unfair to think about this as a one-off situation. It looks as though this is a judge who is showing signs, and there are a variety of instances of him engaging in belligerent, non-cooperative behavior. And the show cause order is the centerpiece, but to say it's an isolated incident is probably a little bit of an exaggeration in the other direction.
Well, possibly, and yet if you had a chief judge who had acted in the way some chief judges in the past have done to try to defuse the situation and to keep the thing from becoming a major blow-up, it might have worked out better.
But he won't even talk to his fellow judges? I mean, how do you do that with a guy who's refusing to talk to his colleagues?
Well, we don't know whether either the actual chief judge or the acting chief judge made any attempt to remedy this. We just don't know that. Again, he's a problem, no question of that. But it does seem to me that from the record that the two bodies relied on, I have problems with ordering the mental examination. And just to follow up on that a little bit, in the real pattern and practice misconduct matter, the conduct committee was very careful to lay out a standard for when a pattern and practice of refusing to go along with orders or directives could be misconduct. There's no standard in this opinion for when it's appropriate to order a mental or psychiatric examination. The committee says only that it was reasonable here. It seems to me that looking forward, it's very important to have a standard. And I gather my two co-panelists disagree with me, but I would require that there be evidence of suggesting a disability that is interfering with the judge's performance of his adjudicative functions. If he's really as bad as Ron seems to think he is, there should be some evidence in the record that could be used for that. And yet
that's what they said, Arthur. That is, the committee said that their psychiatrist looked at the record, and that person says the record.
It's not clear on what it's very unclear what the psychiatrist looked at. They don't tell us what he was basing that opinion on. It certainly wasn't on any meetings with Judge Adams.
Yeah.
Where I would agree with Arthur is that I'm not sure that lawyers love standards, but when it comes to mental health, I mean, our history of coming up with, in the legal profession, with standards for ascertaining mental health have not been shining examples of much of anything. But I do agree with him that that explaining what you mean, what you know, for example, in I'm reading here from the Circuit Judicial Council's explanation of what it was doing. It said, you know, a special investigating committee was formed to review the complaint, which focused on the show cause order. During the course of this review, other facts came to light that led to an expansion of the investigation. The investigation was first expanded to determine whether Judge Adams suffered from a mental or emotional disability that renders him unable to discharge the duties of his office. The investigation was later expanded to determine whether Adams committed misconduct by refusing to cooperate with the SIC's investigation into his mental or emotional health. And to me, that implies to me that they did have information leading them to expand the investigation in that way. But at a minimum, where I agree with Arthur is, you know, they can articulate what those grounds are. What did they find to justify, you know, a situation where we know that we aren't going to gaslight judges we don't like just by saying, well, we have trouble, we have concerns about his mental fitness. I think Ron has identified areas where this guy clearly, to me, has problems worth exploring. I wouldn't have minded that being part of the record.
Well, I agree with both of you on that. I think we can thank Judge Adams for one thing. Now that he's brought it to the D.C. Circuit, this should be thoroughly aired. It may well be that the committee of judges investigating Adams was vague to spare the guy's feelings. Normally, you know, I'm not a judge, but if I were a judge and a half a dozen of my colleagues said, we're worried about the way you're acting, we'd feel great if you took this interview with the psychiatrist who couldn't say that you're not nuts. And I don't think I'm nuts. The simplest thing to do would be to do the interview, to meet with the psychiatrist. And if I thought I might be nuts or am nuts, then I'd like to see what the psychiatrist has to say. The judge wants this all aired out in public, and I agree with him. It should be aired out in public, and that's a good thing about him filing this lawsuit as opposed to just refusing to have the examination. And you know, what does the appellate court do next? Now we're going to have perhaps a seminal case in the D.C. Circuit.
By the way, there's another aspect of this that we haven't mentioned, which is that the new rules at the recommendation of the Breyer Committee specifically authorize a chief judge or acting a chief judge to request a transfer of a misconduct proceeding to a circuit council of another circuit. It seems to me that that would have been a wise thing to do here. I mean, it's clear that the Northern District of Ohio, which is a pretty big district in the Sixth Circuit, you had a lot of animus both from Judge Adams toward the other judges and from the other judges toward Judge Adams. We don't know how much of that may have seeped out into other judges of the Sixth Circuit. I would have a lot more confidence in this, in the ruling of the Circuit Council, if it had been the Circuit Council of another circuit where nobody knew Judge Adams, where they were looking at a record completely de novo with no preconceived notions, and where they, I think, would have put everything into the record that led to, that informed their decision, because they didn't have any background or scuttlebutt or prior knowledge on which to base the decision. So I think the Breyer Committee made an excellent suggestion there, and I don't think I think it should have been followed in this instance.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with Arthur on this one. In my preliminary remarks, you know, I was hinting at that very problem, saying that in your garden variety disciplinary matter, the judges don't have any vested interest in coming down too harshly on their own. Indeed, I think Ron's concern is the opposite, that they are self-protecting. This is an unusual case because in this instance, there is a seeming more of a conflict-like circumstance in which the judges are there angry at one of their own, being very difficult to deal with, and it creates the perception that perhaps they're not coming after him because he's mentally ill, but because he's just a pain in the neck, and we get past that problem by transferring the case to a different circuit. The same way we did with Alex Kaczynski when he was chief judge of the Ninth Circuit, and they shifted it over, what was it, to the Third Circuit when he was under investigation.
To the Third Circuit, and the misconduct proceeding against Judge Jones of the Fifth was shifted to D.C. It's been done a fair amount of time, or I think almost always it's been done with Court of Appeals judges, but there's no reason why it can't be done with a district judge. And for the reasons Charlie has given, I think this was a case where it should have been done, even though it was a district judge.
Well, in Judge Arill's case, after the Ninth Circuit ethics panel ruled against him, it was then, I guess the term is appeal. It was sent to the Judicial Council, and those were judges from other circuits. This came from a district judge, Arill, and with Judge Winters writing a strong dissent, the majority said that we didn't think the law was clear enough to deal with this matter, and gee, if only Congress would fix it. And they didn't do anything like what?
That was the judicial, the National Committee.
Yeah.
That ruled that way, and that was an instance where the majority of the Conduct Committee, as it was then constituted, thought it had no power to review an order of the Chief Judge, an order of the Circuit Council affirming an order of the Chief Judge dismissing a complaint. And in fact, the statute is very clear that the Judicial Conference Committee does not have that authority. They nevertheless put it into the rule, which is an interesting thing for them to have done.
Yeah, but these judges, after so ruling, they thought the problem was Congress. They never told Congress, you know, you got a problem here. They never mentioned Judge Rill's name in their elaborate opinion. They just blamed it on somebody else. We can just differ on. I didn't think the rule was all that clear that the Court of Appeals or the Ninth Circuit couldn't do anything about Judge Arill, who was a major problem in a lot of cases where he was removed. He was disqualified. In fact, he had a running dispute with Judge Kosinski about various matters. And I think that the judges, if anything, are reluctant to point the finger at their fellow judges. But I do think, and I agree with both of you, I think it's good that the D.C. Circuit has this, because we should get a very clarifying ruling about what the ethics people can do. Do they have the power to order a psychiatric exam? And do they have the power to remove him from his caseload? I think it was the Tenth Circuit did that years ago. It went to the Supreme Court, but it wasn't decided on the merits.
Right,
I think,
well, what's interesting about this being in the D.C. Circuit is that Judge Tatel of the D.C. Circuit, in the McBride case, which was raised some similar issues, made the point that the judicial independence guaranteed by the Constitution does exist to protect individual judges as well as to protect the judiciary institution from infringement by other branches. So if this case goes from the district court to a panel with Judge Tatel, there's at least one judge who believes that it's not just the institutional judiciary, but the independence of individual judges.
From other judges, you mean?
Protects.
From other judges.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. I mean, I think it protects them individually. But what do you do when the judge is senile, has dementia, Alzheimer's, and still wants to hear cases?
Well, what's interesting, though, Ron, is that, and Charlie's aware of a lot of this history, too, is that the problem is almost always solved behind the scenes.
Right.
Judges have been very, very effective in the kind of cases Ron described. I remember hearing one chief judge describe how was a judge, long career, refused to resign. The chief judge talked to the judge's wife, said to him, look, if this ever gets out into public, it will be a terrible way to end a very distinguished career. And the wife sat down with her husband and persuaded him. So a good chief judge can do an awful lot behind the scenes, and we always see is a single line in saying, you know, Judge so-and-so resigned or took senior status effective on
There's
such and such.
There's a beautiful example in the book by Woodward and Scott Armstrong, Bob Woodward and Scott Armstrong, called The Brethren, Inside the U.S. Supreme Court. And they talk about Justice Douglas. There came a time when Chief Justice Berger had the unpleasant task of persuading Justice Douglas to retire, take senior status. And that was difficult, but he did that. And then there's an interesting coda to that story. What they said is there came a capital punishment case. And Douglas thought that even though he was retired or took senior status, he still was a justice of the Supreme Court, and he could write opinions in cases anyway. And he gave an opinion to his law clerk to send to the printer in a capital punishment case. And the law clerk talked to Chief Justice Berger, and they just refused to deliver it. And Douglas, who was going in and out of reality, did not push it. We like these things to be taken care of by just reasonable people talking to each other. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, I mean, in my first tenure piece, I had the luxury of being able to interview virtually all present and former chief judges of the circuit courts. And to a man and a woman, they preferred dealing with these things informally. They took great pride in their ability to work informally with the judges, particularly on matters of disability. That includes mental disability and drug and alcohol dependence. I read this case a little differently, perhaps, than Arthur does. This doesn't strike me as being an exceptional case because the chief judge wasn't doing what chief judges normally do, but because the target judge wasn't doing what target judges normally do.
I don't disagree with that, Charlie, but to me, the question is, and it's a very difficult question, I don't pretend to have an answer, you know, what kind of procedures do you want for the one case in 100 or one case in 200 where the ordinary procedures don't work?
Right.
And the... That is, I think, the tough question here. I was going through the history of the 1980 Act, and one of the architects of the Act was Judge Jim Browning of the Ninth Circuit, who I had the privilege of working with for many years. And he was talking about the informal procedures, and he said this: "I have two slight caveats as to the effectiveness of the present informal procedures. The first has to do with the irascible, overbearing judge, the man who gets on the bench and mistreats counsel on occasion. That is very difficult to deal with." We could be talking about Judge Adams here. "I have come to the conclusion," I'm quoting Judge Browning now, "I have come to the conclusion it may be in large part the price we pay for individualism. I don't know how you compel a judge to be polite by legislation or by regulation without really meddling too much." And, you know, that question is still with us almost 40 years later.
It is, although...
Can we go to audience questions?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions. Charlie, I think you were about to say something?
Yeah, I mean, I was just saying, most of my work these days is done in state systems, where the Judge Browning's conundrum is pretty easily resolved. In other words, that the culture of state systems is, everyone swears to abide by a code of conduct, which includes the duty to be courteous and not abusive. And, you know, you go over a period of years, you get an increasingly severe sanctions until you get suspended for, you know, it's not a conceptual conundrum. It's a conundrum that is owing to the structure of the federal courts.
There is something that Congress could do. I mean, this judge was a state judge beforehand. It's possible that, like Saul on the road to Damascus, there's a dramatic change when he becomes a federal judge. But Congress very often either doesn't pay much attention to the trial judges or if it does, they're worried about issues like abortion. They ought to spend a lot more time, for all the judges, on judicial temperament. If this fellow had has had a problem when he was a state judge with respect to judicial temperament, that's something they should have gone into. That might not have solved it here, because there's something, I think, very really liberating about knowing that the only thing the Court of Appeals can do to you is reverse you, and there's so many things that are within the trial judge's discretion that they can't, that you can still hurt a lot of litigants if that's what you're planning to do. But they could look into the judicial temperament of people who were judges or judges in the state court system. The other thing that federal judges can do if they want to is try to act more courteous. I remember going to an oral argument in the Court of Military Appeals, Article I judges. At the end of the oral argument, the three or five judges on the bench came down and shook the hands of the lawyers. And then they went back on the bench and they heard the next argument. That was just a sense of courteousness and that I've never seen in a federal appellate court. And
I think the Fourth Circuit does that. Does that?
That's excellent idea. I think more should do it. I think that will the things like inns of court are supposed to be helpful too, where the judges meet and break bread with the lawyers before them. You're less likely to call them a nincompoop if you just had a shared a steak with them the night before. So those are a lot of things you can try to do.
But on your point about vetting the judges adequately, two things. One, this behavior of Judge Adams started in 2008 when his preferred candidate for magistrate judge wasn't. So it wasn't something apparently that, he was a pretty normal judge until then. He wasn't uncooperative and so forth. But there are some failures in the vetting process. The most obvious one, and the one that I still find somewhat baffling, was Judge Porteous of Louisiana, who was a corrupt judge as a state judge, and yet somehow the FBI, the ABA, the White House, nobody picked up on that before he was appointed to the federal bench. I mean, I guess there was a code of silence there in Louisiana that just nobody gave the slightest hint, or the people doing the investigating were just blind to the whatever hints might have been in front of their eyes.
You know, I testified at his Senate trial, and I was just stunned. It was this cornucopia of misconduct that seemed to sort of somehow escape notice until then.
Well, that's another thing. When in the old days, when judges got convicted, they resigned from the federal bench. Otto Kerner was one of the examples. And now it seems the judge will say, I'm still a judge. I'll keep getting my salary until you remove me by impeachment. And so we've had judges who are getting full salaries while sitting in federal prison. Talk about being denied having your DACA taken away from you. I don't think they hear any cases. It would be very convenient for them to hear the bail cases. They're already in prison. But they don't. And so we do have an era where the judges who should be embarrassed decide they'd want to have another year of salaries and force the Senate to impeach them.
I'll make a final call for questions. To ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Oh, it looks like we have our first question of the day.
In reading the introduction, I was a little concerned, and when Professor Hellman began giving the briefing on this case, I got even more concerned. I'm not here to say I would like to see judges basically gaslighted, but what do you see as potential ADA concerns here? I can imagine a judge who has been shown to be mentally incompetent saying, yes, but there are reasonable accommodations that you could make, scheduling, et cetera, which could permit some participate or my keeping my job. What do you see as ADA implications for cases like this with mentally ill judges?
Well, it's an intriguing
judges?
Question. I doubt that the judge would admit that he was disabled, so it's probably not likely to arrive. Charlie, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, ADA specifically, I can't answer, but I can address the question in a more general way, which is that the first step in these processes, for the most part, these often come to the attention of the circuit before a complaint is filed, and the judge is dealing with these issues informally. When a complaint is filed, again, the first recourse is to deal with it informally, and it's built into the disciplinary process where you can dismiss the complaint because remedial action has been taken. And working with, and just over the course of the interviews I conducted with chief judges, the first recourse is if the judge has a temperament issue, you explore an alternative to discipline, which would be anger management. You look at drug and alcohol treatment options for judges whose diligence and competence are being adversely affected by, you know, those kinds of disabilities. And I think it's probably safe to say that with judges with anxiety disorders and depression and so forth, that treatment is the first choice before you go down these other roads, just because that's just the culture of the judiciary, irrespective of ADA. And I do anticipate that if you abandon that cultural norm, that the judge in question would say, hold on just a bloody minute, you know, that I have depression, but I'm now getting treatment, I'm now going to be able to function. And so the question in this case is, you know, whether he's mentally ill or a jerk. And that's sort of the focal point.
It is. Well, just to add to that, there was a case, I won't even mention the judge's name because it was cleared up. I mean, he had some similar anger. He was abusive toward lawyers. It wasn't a problem with staff, but lawyers. And he agreed to counseling and treatment, and it worked. And at the end of it, lawyers were saying he was doing a great job. He's sitting on the bench now very effectively. So this is as Charlie has been saying, this is an extraordinarily rare instance, and I think we should be very wary of making precedents for the episode that is so rare. And I also agree with Charlie that you don't want to diminish the effectiveness of the informal processes.
In the case of Judge Brian Duff, he had said a decade of erratic behavior, which sure looked mental, not physical. But what they finally did after the Justice Department wanted him disqualified in all cases involving the Department of Justice, he agreed to basically take early retirement before he was otherwise entitled to, and they call it, the chief judge called it, a legitimate physical disability. There may not be a provision for getting your full pay in retirement because of mental problems, but the judges, once the judge himself realizes he shouldn't be on the bench and their anger management is not going to cure the problem, we can do that so that he stops harming the litigants. But one problem is, there were years ago, periodically they talk about we should force judges to retire because they go on well past their prime. And my experience, and what lawyers who litigate far more than I do say, is that the really good judges know when there's a problem with them. They're getting a bit too old, and they just take senior status and sometimes never hear a case again because they want to go out with a good feeling and not a bad one. It is the small number of judges, I think Arthur's right, that don't seem to see it that way, and it's hard for them to recognize that they have a problem. I mean, they say the first cure, the first step in dealing with alcoholism is to admit you're an alcoholic, and the first step, if you have a mental disability, is to recognize you have one, and if an objective psychiatrist told Judge Adams he had one, maybe he would act differently and try to to deal with it. In any event, we're going to learn a lot from this. I'm really very pleased that the judge filed the lawsuit, because we should learn a lot from the D.C. Circuit decision when it comes down how many months or years from now.
It looks like we're up on our time, so would any of you all like to make some closing remarks?
I think I've said what I have to say.
Ditto?
Well, yeah, that makes three of us.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We will welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.